2 weeks ago, what could have been the world's biggest gold mine under construction in Chile was halted, for now at least. A Chilean court stopped work by the giant Canadian company Garrick Gold, high up in the Andes on the Chilean-Argentinian border. Indigenous groups had successfully argued that the environmental damage to a glacier-fed river would be too great. Now, here in Australia, Woodside cancelled its massive liquefied natural gas project at James Price Point in the Kimberley. With such decisions, the fate of many is swung one way or another. And in mining, of course, there are always competing arguments about benefits. But is there an underlying ethical framework to guide the decision-making and operations of mining? No, it would seem. Sheffer Siegel has written a terrific piece on a topic that very surprisingly few seem to have tackled, the aforementioned ethics or lack thereof of mining. Or The Missing Ethics of Mining, as he's titled his essay, which he wrote for the Carnegie Council's Ethics and International Affairs website. Sheffer is an environmental writer. He's in the White Horse Studio in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to our little writers' program, Sheffer.
Thank you so much.
Sheffer, for reasons that I won't bore you with, the listener that you're talking to is called Gladys, and you have a dire prediction about gold and other minerals, and I think it's only ethical that we disclose this to Gladys right now so she can consider her investment portfolio.
Well, I think we're seeing right now, as we're speaking over the last week, and it's been taking place over the last few weeks, especially during this whole month of April, we're seeing the beginning of what appears to be the collapse of the historic rise in gold prices that we've watched gold prices go from about $250 a troy ounce after September 11, 2001 to briefly over $2,000 an ounce, and it's now finally dropping after a 10-11 year run. And the biggest effect that this is going to have is that it's going to cut into the attempted expansion, a proposed doubling of production, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, that the gold mining industry has been hoping to achieve over the next 5 years.
In other words, gold production becomes uneconomic. It's almost invariably a pretty pricey stuff to mine, isn't it?
It is, and it can also be terribly profitable and productive if the market price is and remains high enough, and that's part of what the gold mining sector as a whole has been working very hard to achieve over the last decade.
Are you suggesting that they can manipulate the price of gold in the way that, say, De Beers used to the price of diamonds?
I don't think they have quite that control over the market. There are too many variables, but over the last 10 years, what they've managed to do is to securitize the gold by creating what are called exchange-traded funds, and that's opened up investment in gold to the masses in a way that it's never been available before. And so a big part of what we've been seeing, especially since the financial collapse of 2008, is not simply, as many commentators say, it's not simply the reliance on gold as a hedge in dark economic times. It's that the World Gold Council, which is a consortium of many of the major gold mining companies in the world, has been consolidating gold so that it's now the fifth largest holder of gold in the world, behind four governments. And so that has helped the price stay up above $1,500 an ounce. And they're now starting to lose control of that. The SPDR, as it's called, which is the biggest of these exchange-traded funds, has seen a very big collapse over the last couple of weeks. So I think we're starting to see some of that unravel on the gold mining industry.
And as you point out, the same process of unraveling may be occurring in a number of other mineral areas. It's interesting that you bring a fascinating combination of abilities and backgrounds. The worship of gold reminds me that you started off in religious studies. Give us a potted bio.
Well, what's true, I was a serious religious studies student as a young man, and later decided to go into environmental studies. And shortly after I finished a graduate degree in environmental studies in Boston, I took a trip to the rainforest in Guyana in South America and hired a guide to take me to an exquisite waterfall that's five times the drop of Niagara Falls. And quite...
I'm sorry, five times the drop?
Five times the drop of Niagara Falls, yeah. It's called Kaichur Falls. It's, if ever you have the opportunity, it's worth the trip. I was walking up the river, and unbeknownst to me, there was a gold rush going on. I mean, everybody else in the country knew that, but I was unaware of it. And one morning I woke up, and there was a man who had come in from his mine, and he pulled out a ball of mercury, which I assumed, of gold, I should say, which I assumed to be a nugget of gold. And he promptly started, pulled out a blowtorch and started roasting the gold. And this caught my eye because I didn't understand why you would have to roast the gold. And he said, well, we're just burning off the mercury because when we mine the gold this way, this is a small-scale miner, I should say. This is somebody working at an artisanal or manual level. This is not a major gold mining company of the type that we would see that we often talk about. And so I asked him, what are you doing? He said, we're just burning off the mercury. It's okay. So it turns out that in this industry, which is not very well studied, the mercury and gold have a kind of romantic relationship. They associate very well. So if you combine if you put mercury into you combine it in the ore, it will form an amalgam with the gold, which makes the gold more easily extractable. That caught my eye in a way that I was very unprepared for. And I started to have fantasies about going to mine for gold myself, and I was trying to understand what's happening here, and I realized that was gold fever, that I was in a gold rush area, and I was experiencing gold fever, which is not a metaphor. It's something that happens to you, grips your body physically, existentially. And so that started a sort of a 10-year path for me of studying the mining industry and gold in particular.
And, of course, mercury, because it's a neurotoxin, isn't it?
Absolutely, and this small-scale gold mining industry, which we don't talk about very often, has been exploding over the last at least 20 years, really since the beginning of the Brazilian gold rush in the late 1970s, going into the 1980s. And then we've seen really astonishing growth in that sector with the rise of the gold prices over the last 10 years because there are very low barriers to entry in this. It's one of the few remaining industries where if everything else collapses around you, which it is in many of the places where there is still gold remaining, you can go into small-scale gold mining with relatively little equipment. And mercury, though it's gone up in price over the last 10 years, is still very cheap compared to the price of gold. And so despite it being a powerful neuro and also nephrotoxin affecting the kidneys, this is the last really great remaining use of elemental mercury in the world. In every other industry, we've seen the decline, and we're working towards the phasing out of mercury. In small-scale gold mining, we've only seen it escalating dramatically and frighteningly over the last.
And as you point out, mercury has a nasty habit of accumulating in the food chain, and once it gets in there, there's bugger all you can do about it.
Yeah, that's right, and it exposes a real predicament inside the sort of environmental policymaking world because on the one hand, even if you could control it, which it's nearly impossible to control these small-scale sectors because they tend to be rural and remote and hard to control under the best of circumstances. Even if you could control it, you have a problem because that industry is supporting many of the world's poorest people, and yet it's phenomenally contaminative. And so we don't have an answer to that problem in the kind of places where this is occurring because we don't have alternatives for the people economically.
Take us off to the country of Burkina Faso. Tell us the story.
Well, I wanted to tell this story in the essay. It's been something that was on my mind for a long time because in 2008, I did a consulting contract for an agency of the World Bank, and they sent me to a place I'd never been where I had no expertise, which is actually quite common in this kind of work. And they sent me to a mining area called Essakane. And in this area people had been mining gold there since the mid-1980s when they started to rely on gold because there was terrible drought in that part of West Africa. And gold was something of a savior for the people of the region. So after 3 or 4 years of drought, they started to move more heavily into the gold mining. This is small-scale or artisanal gold mining that I was talking about before. And the gold really saved the community in many ways. But, of course, at the same time, what happens is as soon as you have a gold rush or a gold industry breaks out in any region of the world, gold mining companies from all over the world are also they're tracing these rushes, and they rely on them to look for, as part of their exploration strategies, to look for new deposits. So over time, that had become an area of interest for many gold mining companies, especially Canadian companies, where many of the gold mining companies in the world are housed. And I was traveling there with the there's a kind of most of the companies these days tend to have something like a sociologist in-house who's responsible for relating to the communities directly. And we were traveling around the mine and talking about the water that would be required for the mine. And he said, well, there's a river here that flows 3 months out of the year if we're lucky, and that's what's going to provide the water for the mine. We'll have to dam it. And I said, well, what about the people who live downstream? Well, don't they rely on that? And he said quite chillingly, this is a question we do not discuss out loud. So I realized at that point that there was a real problem with the way that the kinds of assessments of these mining projects are done, because I was called in to do something of a human rights assessment, or so it's called, looking at whether the compensation formulas, meaning when companies come in and they displace the communities and are required to compensate the communities for their loss of land, though not necessarily their resources. But those compensation formulas are executed separately from any kind of environmental evaluation.
And herein lies the ethical dilemma for those working in mining or alongside it. Is it ever possible to raise the appropriate concerns without losing your job?
I haven't seen instances where those kinds of concerns have been raised or where that voice wins out. I think that there may be cases out there, but I think that the idea that there might be limits or constraints to the expansion of mining, and I'm thinking particularly of minerals and precious metals, but it applies to any extractive resource.
Well, in New South Wales, and I'm sitting in Sydney at the moment, there's about 1,200 applications for new coal mines or indeed extensions of existing ones. And judging on past history, well over 1,000 of them will get the nod, despite communal protests, despite concerns about water, and the pollution of aquifers, et cetera, despite the fact that this will often destroy the entire infrastructure of a community, crushing farming as people are lured off to the mines. Is there anywhere in the world where all these issues are properly balanced?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of. I mean, one of the things that intrigues me about and quite honestly upsets me about the way the expansion of mining occurs right now is that people will tend to assume that there is something dramatically different about the way mining expansion happens, say, in sub-Saharan Africa or in northern Canada and Australia. In reality, there isn't much difference. I mean, the kinds of conflicts that I might run into in West Africa or in Latin America are just as likely to be to occur in northern Canada, are occurring in northern Canada. Yeah. And I know that in Australia these are big issues for you too.
And there's no international law, is there? I mean, international law hardly exists, but it certainly doesn't seem applicable to mining.
No, I mean, there have been numerous compacts and voluntary non-binding agreements that have been cut over the last 10, 15 years now. None of them particularly effective. And one of the reasons that this came out as an ethics article in the Carnegie Council's journal, Ethics and International Affairs, is that part of what we're discussing here is that what's the basis or the framework, for to use a kind of bureaucratic term, for building these or designing these compacts and agreements. And right now, the frameworks really are built on two concepts, whether one is corporate social responsibility and the other is transparency. And these, first of all, are two different things, but they also omit the very concept of ecological limits. So no matter how socially responsible a mining corporation may be, no matter how transparent they may be with their fiscal arrangements in the countries where they're mining, in the host countries, that has no bearing on whether we're evaluating if this is a mine that can, you know, coexist with the ecological limits and the culture of the places where they're mining. And we don't have any kind of framework that looks at how to evaluate specific mining projects from that perspective.
My guest is Shefa Segal, and this is LNL on RN. Let's go back to the report you had to write in Africa based on those International Finance Corporation standards for resettlement. Just talk to that, because there was plenty of room for inadequacy.
Well, the standard practice in the industry right now, and you know, any mine of the kind of scale that mines typically are right now is going to require the displacement of a huge number of people. And we're talking sometimes, you know, in the tens of thousands. In that particular instance, I asked the people responsible for the resettlement plan, so you're going to move the community from where they are now to this other place, but what about their jobs? They're gold miners, and you're going to be mining the gold that they're mining right now. What will they do? And the standard practice is to find them what are called alternative livelihoods, and that means we're going to turn them into farmers. Even if they haven't been farmers for many years or they never were farmers, they're going to be farmers and we're going to mine. But of course, if you're moving 10,000 people, who knows how to create 10,000 jobs? There's no mining company in the world that knows how to create 10,000 jobs on the spot.
I like the place in your essay where you remind us that so-called standards are heavy with terms like minimize, mitigate, and adequate, as in minimize involuntary resettlement or mitigate adverse impacts. It's a rhetoric of imprecision.
Well, that's exactly right, and it is a rhetoric of imprecision, because what does that mean to minimize adverse impacts? I mean, who's deciding what the adverse impacts are? I'll tell you something. In that particular case, I was working as both a human rights assessor and a management consultant, which is to say that I wasn't an independent consultant. I worked for the World Bank, and in that case, my responsibility was to evaluate the human rights practices of the company. But at the same time, the consulting firm that I was attached to wanted to be management consultants to the mining company, in which case their objective is to tell the mining company what they want to hear so that they can work directly for the mining company. So there is no independent arbiter in these circumstances.
I noticed in Australia in recent years that almost every ecological scholar get sort of caught up in the mining business. They tend, in fact, to be neutralized by becoming contractors, advisors to the mining companies. But let's go back to your villagers who were going to be told that farming became compulsory. You went to them and asked them how they'd feel about farming.
Right.
And one bloke says, if we cannot mine, we cannot live. And you make the point there, their kids were raised as miners, sleeping as infants, strapped to their mothers' backs while the women washed gold. And by the age of 8, they were crushing stones with metal pestles.
That's right. And because I wanted to understand, what was it that the miners wanted? I understood that the people working for the mining company envisioned an agrarian life for the miners. But what did they want? And for them, they said their response is, we're miners. We've been miners since the 1980s. We no longer know how to farm. Even if the land were arable, we wouldn't know how to do it. And certainly our children wouldn't know how to do it. And so at a certain point in the conversation with the villagers, I said to them, well, would you be amenable to all becoming farmers? And one of the men said to me, he said very pointedly, he said, I want you to understand something. What you fear is not what I fear. Every day of my life is a war. Can you set me free? That hung, that statement out there, that question, can you set me free, hung there for a long time, because what they're seeing, what people in these in the communities are seeing, is that a mining company is capable of coming in and establishing a camp that is decked out with every symbol of modern progress that you can imagine, and they have good water, they have electricity.
Well, that certainly happened in Essakane, didn't it? Because as you described, suddenly there's many of the manifestations of a modern society side by side with these impoverished people.
Yeah, well, what's going on exactly? I mean, why is it that the mining companies need to bring in separate development agencies? And it has to be, you know, such a complicated process to bring economic development to these places. And what that really means is putting in $1 million here, $1 million there. And the result of that is maybe some increased living standards in the communities, maybe a clinic, maybe a school, but probably with no teachers. Why is it that it takes so long to get so little for the communities, but in a year's time, the mining company can have everything set up in that place? Why is that not extended? Why are the roads that are built to go into the mine and into the mine camp, why are they not extended to the communities? Why is it that the pipelines that are built to transport water from the nearest source to get into the camp so that there's drinking water in the camp, why is that not extended to the communities?
And of course, the other irony here is that mines come and go, and when they go, they leave behind them a landscape of ruin. Even if there's sort of token attempts at restoration, it's never the same again, and often the water is gone or so corrupted, so polluted, as to be unusable.
Well, those areas become areas of sacrifice. We just have to accept that. We have to stop pretending that it's otherwise. And, you know, we can have the discussion about whether there is a case to be made that there are some areas that need to be sacrificed in order to serve our material needs. I'm happy to have that discussion. But to pretend that the result of that what's left behind by the mining companies is anything other than areas of sacrifice is to try to fool ourselves about what really happens there. And that's not just true in sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America. That's true in where I'm from, in North America. I mean, you go to the places that were the hotbeds of mining at the turn of the 20th century, and they are the most polluted places in the world now.
As you say, the rights and conditions vary enormously from country to country. To some extent, Australia's indigenous people are in a much stronger position these days as a result of land rights legislation, but the deals don't always go their way, and constant vigilance is needed.
Yeah, well, we are seeing, and I wish I could speak more directly to the case in Australia, but I know that you know it very well. We are seeing in different places a much more vocal response from communities, especially indigenous communities, in places that are deeply affected by resource extraction. Unfortunately, I think that right now there are so many projects that are either moving into production as we speak or are scheduled to move into production very soon that I think, you know, the local community movements are just overwhelmed by the scale of these fights over the mines.
But every now and again, there is a moment of hope. And we were talking about the case of Chile, where the courts provide the role of arbiter of ethics and fairness.
Yeah, but only for a particular mine in a particular place. I don't think it affects the I don't think we can extrapolate from one case to the direction of all of these industries. And I think overall, whether it's Australia, Canada, or sub-Saharan Africa, I think overall right now the policy landscape is rigged and increasingly rigged to promote mining expansion.
Well, one of the ways it's rigged, as you point out, is that development agencies and other NGOs who might become involved in a mining project are competing for funding, and oft get it from the mining companies themselves.
All the time. I mean, that's because, where else is their money these days? And that's part of the conundrum right now, is that as, the economy has become tighter and tighter, the work that the development agencies and NGOs, and increasingly, I want to point out, increasingly universities. Universities are really becoming a big asset in the objectives of the mining companies. That where I did my PhD at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, they just received a $25 million grant from the Canadian International Development Agency to develop the extractive industries, the Institute for Extractive Industries and Development, I think it's called. No environment in the title whatsoever, right? So you can see the direction where that stuff is going. And, the universities should have a big role to play here, in that they should be stressing research and development to try to modernize the mining industries and to figure out how we're going to turn these things into sustainable industries.
This is like an echo of what happened to the universities as a result of the power of the industrial military complex, I guess. Look, the overarching point you make is that the scarcity of resources and large-scale operations that try to extract small amounts of low-grade material doesn't serve anyone's interest.
Well, that really is the key, and that's something that's been lost in a lot of the noise and around this subject, is that if you compare the grade, which just means the amount of the percentage of the material that you're mining per ton of ore. So if you compare that now to 100 years ago, and the reason I'm saying 100 years ago is because that was another big boom period around the turn of the 20th century. So a mine today, a gold mine today, might process 10 million tons of ore per year to extract 10 tons of gold. That's the same amount that a mine of that previous era, say around 1900, would have mined in the lifetime, in the 45 or 50-year lifetime of the mine. And so, what we're talking about is something that's on a scale that nobody ever imagined. And the reason for that is because the quality, the grade of the gold has dropped to what would have been an average, going back 100 years, of an ounce per ton, if not more. There were many cases where it was 4 ounces, 5 ounces, even 20 ounces per ton, and we're now at below a gram per ton. And it's not uncommon for especially many of the gold mines now that are being proposed are well below a gram per ton, even half a gram or less than a half a gram per ton. And the only thing that makes those kinds of mines potentially economical and profitable is the sky-high gold price. Without that, the mines don't work.
And as you say, gold is a sort of a bellwether for other materials. Now, once upon a time, it was common to salt mines. These days, of course, there's a tendency to exaggerate the size of deposits because, well, they tend to be overstated to encourage investment.
Well, that's one thing that is not new in the mining industry. That's one thing that they've been that's been a common practice for a long time. It's something that Herbert Hoover, one of the great American mining engineers — people forget that Hoover, of course, was one of the great mining engineers
spent quite a bit of time in Australia, as it happens.
That's right. And in fact, when I'm talking about the average grade of gold, I'm talking about the mines in Australia that he oversaw. He didn't like any mine that had less than an ounce of gold per ton.
Sorry, it is an amazing notion. An ounce per ton, for heaven's sake.
Well, that one of the incredible things about going to visit an industrial scale gold mine right now is that you'll never see gold. Right? You can tour the entire operation, you can go through the processing plant, you don't see the gold. You have to believe that it's there. Right? But Hoover was somebody who was, he had a policy at a certain point. I think it was in Australia, but I might be remembering that incorrectly, of opening up the mine periodically for people to come and see it. Because that was to try to eliminate this notion of miners as crooks, which is an idea that's been around for a long, long time, because they were constantly overvaluing their resources. The reason they do that, though, is because, first of all, they don't know exactly what it is that they've found until they go in and mine for it. So there's always some guesswork involved.
And even with all the technologies, very often major mining companies are enormously embarrassed after they pour, you know, a couple of squillion dollars into a venture to find there's not as much there as they'd hoped?
Well, look, I think, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but I think that there is a connection right now between the fall of the gold price and the inability of the companies to follow through on the promises they've made to their investors. And, you know, they've committed so much to mines that have such low grades and are so remote and in such dangerous places that it was always going to be a question mark whether they were really going to be able to get the resources out of the ground. And I think we're finding out now that they can't. And it's because the costs of production are just too high. And one of the reasons the costs are is so high is because the communities don't want it.
Schaefer, we're about to lose our connection, but I thank you terribly much for your time. Schaefer Siegel, for getting us all thinking about this in new ways, is an environmental and mining writer, and he's written a piece called The Missing Ethics of Mining for the Carnegie Council's Ethics and International Affairs website, and we'll have a link to it on our site. Good on you, Schaefer. Coming up, an Australian war hero who almost entirely vanished from history.